Couple of things I want to point out before we get started in this lesson. Number one, the very last page on this handout that I gave you is blank. It's blank for a reason. It gives you a close glimpse of my mind. No. It is blank because, for note taking, for those of you who like to take a lot of notes, when we get to the fourth or the last question, the dream interpreted, there's going to be a lot more said than probably what we got. It was kind of difficult setting up the study guide for this, simply because although there's a lot of good lessons in Daniel, and there are a lot of good lessons, we're not focusing upon all the lessons of Daniel. What we are trying to do in this class is to focus upon how you and I can get a firm biblical foundation on what is taught in Daniel versus what is taught in the other parts of the religious world. We want to understand Daniel in the sense that we can fight error, and in the sense that we can teach others the truth that is in Daniel. Now, as we went through last week, we finished up the introduction to Daniel, and we also went over a historical background of Daniel from the year 605 BC to 70 AD. This is the historical timeline and the historical or the prophecies in the book of Daniel. Now, the reason why I'm emphasizing that again is because, like I said, when you read other people, when you listen to other people in religious bodies, when you see them on the TVs, when you see them or hear commentaries from your co-workers, you may hear some things that are not in agreement with what I say. So we want to have a firm biblical foundation. Now, if there is in some way a situation in which we have a debate upon what's being said, we want to make sure that our debate comes from a biblical foundation, okay? And that's the only way that you and I will be able to win souls. Because if we can show failure in the teachings of others in one place, then it may make people open up and look at what they're being taught. And that's our whole purpose, okay? So there's a lot of good things in Daniel, but we're not going to be studying everything in Daniel. Our focus is upon understanding the difficult passages and, of course, learning better or getting a good biblical foundation. In saying that, doesn't mean that we're not going to read it. Remember, I want you to read the first six chapters of Daniel and the first six chapters only of Daniel at least three times as we go through this study. When we get to the apocalyptic section, which is Daniel 7 through 12, then we'll even slow down even more and we'll take these passages of Scripture as we come to them, okay? All right. So, if you notice on your study guide, I gave an outline of the book of Daniel. That's something for you to pursue upon your own, something for you to study. And when you get a chance to teach Daniel, perhaps this will help you prepare your lessons in the book of Daniel. So, we want to pick up in Daniel chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, and read through 1 through 13. And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep went from him. Then the king commanded to call the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king of his dreams. Now remember, this phrase Chaldean can be used in an ethical sense. It can also be used in a religious sense. And here it appears to be used in a religious sense. So the king has a dream. He dreams dreams. So evidently it appears that it's a reoccurring dream. And it troubles him. He's losing sleep over it. Verse 3, and the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in the Syrian language. Some of your translations say Aramaic. In the study that I've read on this, they had a form of Aramaic in their language. So they said something to the Syrian or Aramaic language. O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing has gone from me. If you make not known unto me the dream and interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut into pieces, and your houses shall be made into dunghill. So as we look at the very first question on your study guide, how did the dream affect Nebuchadnezzar? It appears that it made him lose sleep. It troubled him. Caused him to have insomnia. He calls his wise men. Now you remember in our introduction I said sometimes we're going to hear the word liberal. Liberals here say, why didn't they call Daniel and his friends? I mean, after all, they answered the questions. Well, I don't know. Perhaps like you and I, when you have a problem or a situation, we go to the people that we know best and trust first before we go to the new guys. I don't know. But the liberals will use this to show that Daniel was not written during the time by Daniel, nor during the time of Daniel. Also, it's important to point out, as you look at this passage of Scripture for your own study, that from here in chapter 2, I think around verse 4, to chapter 7, 28, the only manuscripts we have are in Aramaic, and the liberals will point out that this form of Aramaic did not come out until the 2nd and 3rd century B.C., which is not true because we have manuscripts as far back as the 9th century B.C. in this type of language. So the liberals will try and defeat the cause that Daniel wrote the book and that Daniel is a true person because they want to get away with all predictive prophecy. So keep that in mind, too, as we go through this study. And you will see this in some of your outside resources. So anyway, he says, I'll cut you to pieces, make your house into dunghill. Some of your translations will make your houses into desolate. The idea that here is just simply, they're living in good places, good houses. He will tear those houses down, and he will kill their families. So that's the idea. That's the king's reaction, if you don't make known. Now, some of your commentators will say that maybe Nebuchadnezzar did not forget the dream, and he's testing his wise men. Maybe true, I don't know. But anyway, whatever it is, they cannot do it. Now, as we pick up in verse 6, but if you show me the dream and the interpretation thereof, you shall receive from me of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. They answered a second time, let the king tell us the dream, and we will show the interpretation. And the king says, I know for certainty that you would gain time, because you see the thing is gone from me. So anyway, he says, you're stalling. You can't do it. Verse 10, the Chaldeans answered before the king and said, there is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter, for as much no king, no lord, or ruler has asked such a thing or of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. And it is a rare thing that the king requires, and there is no other that can show it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. Now here they say an indictment unto themselves. This is a true saying. An indictment unto themselves. Okay, so in verse 12, for this cause the king was angry and very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went forth and the wise men were to be slain. And they sought Daniel and his companions to be slain also. So here we have the forgotten dream. The king calls in his wise men, tells them, tell me what the interpretation is. They don't know. Tell me the dream. It's gone from me. And if you cannot tell me the dream, then I am going to kill you and tear down your houses. So there's the king's dream, his reaction, who he called, and the reaction to their failure. Now, as we pick up in verse 14 through following, we see Daniel's request. Picking up in 14, then Daniel returned answer with counsel and prudence to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said, Arioch, the king's captain, wherefore is the decree so urgent from the king? So then Arioch made this thing known to Daniel, and Daniel went in to desire of the king that he would appoint him a time, and he would show the king an interpretation. Okay, so now Daniel hears what's going on. He goes to the captain of the guard. He wants to know why the king is so angry. He is told what it is. He makes a request for an audience with the king. Now, notice the last part of 16, where he says, and he would show the king the interpretation. Now, there's no indication that Daniel had ever done this before. What assurance would Daniel have that he could do this? I think here that we see the faith of Daniel in the one in whom he trusts. So there's a great lesson that you and I can learn from there. Even though the odds seem against you, we keep our trust and our faith in the Lord and in the Father, and things will work out all right. Pick it up in 17. And he went to the house, and he made the thing known to Hannah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire the mercies of the God who concerning this secret. This phrase, this word secret, occurs some 8 times in the book of Daniel, in chapter 2, excuse me. Verse 19, that Daniel and his companions should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the secret was revealed unto Daniel in a vision of the night. And Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changed the times and the season. He removes the kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that have understanding. He reveals the deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells within him. I thank you and praise you, O you God of my fathers, who have given me wisdom and might and have now made known unto me what we desire of you. For you have made known unto us the king's matter. Therefore Daniel went unto Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Daniel. And he went and said thus unto him, destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. So here we are, 4 things that we are reminded of in Daniel's prayer. This is point number 3. Okay, point number 2, we've discussed. Daniel required of the king, give me a day or two and I'll give you the answer to your dream. And then point 3, 4 things about God we are reminded of in Daniel's prayer. And this is where we're at now. First thing, the sovereignty of God. The sovereignty of God. He changes the times and the seasons. He changes the times and the seasons. He removes and he sets up kings. This tells you and me that everything is in God's control. There is nothing there are none who are not under his control. Whatever is in the spiritual realm is under his control. Whatever is in his physical realm is under his control. So we see the sovereignty of God in Daniel's prayer. The second thing that we see is the consistency of God. The consistency of God. He gives wisdom to the wise. He is the source of wisdom. If you look at, write down, if you will, Proverbs chapter 2, verses 6 through 7. 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 9 through 12, and Exodus 31, verse 3, Proverbs chapter 2, 6 through 7, 1 Kings 3, 9 through 12, and Exodus 31, verse 3. All of these passages and a truckload of other passages show that it is God who gives us wisdom. So we see the consistency of God. The third thing that we see is the omniscience of God. Spit that word out. He knows what is in the darkness. Nothing can be hidden. He has knowledge which lies beyond natural course. If you'll go back to chapter 2 and verse 11, where the Chaldeans say, "And it is a rare thing that the king requires, and there is no other that can show it before the king except the gods," the indictment to themselves. And if you'll look down in verse 28, "But there is a God in heaven that reveals secrets, and he has made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days." So it is God who unbinds, who solves all the hard questions. The light that dwells within him is not the sense of the dwelling in the light of 1 John 5, and chapter 1, 5 and following. The light here is the idea of all knowledge. And then the fourth thing that we see is the immutability and the reliability of God. The immutability and the reliability of God. He, the God of our fathers, he is an old God. There is nothing that hasn't been done, that will be done, that he hasn't seen before. He is old in forgiveness and in pardon. He is old in victory. And he is old in his wrath against sin. He is the God of the old, and he's the God of the young. So these are the four things that we see, or four things about God that we are reminded of. All right, the dream revealed, picking up verse 25. I know I'm going pretty quick, but our purpose here in this chapter will be the statue of the image. And this will take probably about two or three Sundays. Pick it up in verse 25. "Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said unto him, I," heavy on that I. Anytime you want to impress the boss, you run in there, right? "Look what I've done. Look what I've found." Arioch's no different. "I have found a man of the children of the captivity of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. And the king answered and said unto Daniel," whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known unto me the dream that I have seen and the interpretation thereof?" And Daniel answered before the king and said, "The secret which the king has demanded can neither wise men, enchanters, magicians, nor soothsayers show unto the king." And I wish we would all understand that. When I worked for FedEx, I used to deliver to a fortune teller. I remember the first time I brought her a letter. I walked in the door. She said, "What is that?" And I said, "Don't you know?" That came out without even thinking. There were times when I thought about going back in there with a cantaloupe or something. Read this. Tell me what this says. Because you see, if the ability's in the person, you don't need the crystal ball or the tea leaves or anything like that. If it's not in the person, then keep the tea leaves and the crystal ball and get rid of the person. But Daniel makes a true saying in here. It's not me. And we need to understand that. It's not me. It's not you. It's not the elite. It's God working in all of us. But I do all the studying. I do all the preparing. I'm the one who proclaims the message. Doesn't matter. Need to understand who's working in you. And Daniel understood this. But there is a God in heaven who hath revealed, that we're in verse 28, who hath revealed secrets, and he hath made known to the king of Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Your dreams and visions of your head upon your bed are these. And let me stop there. Last week a question came up. What's the difference between dreams and visions? Dreams sometimes happen during sleep time, and visions oftentimes happen during the times of meditation or during times of contemplation upon the word or upon the situation that men are in. But also, if we look here, it appears that dreams and visions are used interchangeably. So I don't see a clear answer to the question. Sometimes dreams happen during the night in your sleep, and sometimes visions happen in a time when you're thinking about something, in a time when meditation or something like that, or sometimes like this, it appears to be interchangeable. Verse 30, but as for me, the secret is not revealed for me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but to the intent that the interpretation may be made known to the king, that you may know the thoughts of your heart. Verse 31. You, O king, saw a great image. As soon as Daniel said that, whether the king had known what his dream was and was testing the wise men, or whether he hadn't known, as soon as Daniel said this, he got the king's attention. The image which was mighty and whose brilliance, brightness was excellent stood before you, and the aspect thereof was terrible. As for the image, its head was of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and thighs of brass, its legs of iron, and its feet of part iron and clay. You saw until that stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon its feet, and that were of iron and clay and break in pieces. Then were the iron and clay, the brass and the silver of the gold broken in pieces together, became like chaff in the summer, of summer threshing floors, and the wind carried away, so that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Okay. Head of gold was Babylon. Head of gold is Babylon. This is point four in your study guide. 626 BC, Babylon was recognized as a world power. 626. The breast and arms of silver are the Medo-Persian Empire. Medo-Persian Empire. October 539 BC, Babylon is destroyed and Medo-Persian Empire under Cyrus the Great becomes known as the world power. Belly and thighs of brass, kingdom of Greece. In 331, at the Battle of Gaugamela. Alexander the Great defeats Darius III. And Greece is recognized as a world power. And then the legs and feet of iron and clay is Rome. 31 BC, the Battle of Actium. Mark Antony is defeated. Cleopatra kills herself, so it's said. Ends the Ptolemy reign of the Grecian kingdom, and Rome now is seen as a world power. So from 626 BC, the head of gold, to 31 BC, Rome. There's your time frame. Now, as you look at the first part, as Daniel talks about the statue, notice the leg and feet of iron or clay, no mention of toes. No mention of toes. Now, when you get down to 41, you'll see toes mentioned, but you'll not see how many toes. Now, this is important. Keep this in mind as we talk about this, for this will be carried over for another couple of weeks, and then when we get to chapter 7, we're going to talk about it again. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning toes is simply because toes are important to the premillennial doctrine. This is the doctrine that a lot of your friends and neighbors believe in. Doctrine that you see your TV preachers preaching upon. It used to be a revived Roman Empire of the 20th century, but for some reason that didn't happen, so now they bumped it up to the 21st century. If you notice in verse, 35, where the stone hits the feet of the statue, and the statue is made like chaff and is blown away in the wind, the dispensationalists will say yes, but the 10 toes still remain. Toes are an important part to the millennial doctrine. The stone will cut without hands is the Messianic kingdom. The Messianic kingdom. Cut without hands indicates divine activity. If you remember when we studied in the book of Revelation, the sea beast and the earth beast come up out of the sea beast comes up out of the sea, the earth beast comes up out of the land, indicates human origin. In chapter 21, we see the city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven, indicates its divine origin. So it's cut without hands. Represents the Messianic kingdom. The dream interpreted, 36 through 45. And this is a dream that we will tell the interpretation there of the king, you, O king, or the king of kings, who... to whom the God of heaven have given kingdom and power and strength and glory, and wheresoever the children of men dwell, and the beast of the field, and the birds of the heaven, hath he given unto your hand, and hath made you to rule over them, you are the head of gold. Now let's stop here. On face value, this tells us that King Nebuchadnezzar ruled every human being upon the earth. Face value. Look what it says. It says, "Hath God of heaven have given the kingdom of power and the strength and glory, and wheresoever the children of men dwell." But we know the realm of the Babylonian Empire. From the Red Sea to the Mediterranean Sea to the Euphrates and the Tigris River to the Persian Gulf. This was the whole of the Babylonian Empire. So King Nebuchadnezzar was not king over the Mayans, the Native Americans, nor the Germanic tribes, nor the Chinese or the Japanese. But here he says, over the whole world, it is figurative speech showing that God hath given Nebuchadnezzar reign over this part of the world. It's kind of like in Colossians 1 and verse 6, where Paul will say that the gospel had been preached throughout the whole world. But it hadn't been preached throughout the whole world during the time of Paul. It would have been preached throughout the Roman world. The Colossian letter was written, and scholars differ, somewhere from 58 to 63 A.D. Some 25 to 30 years after the gospel started on the day of Pentecost. Figurative speech sometimes, or speech in the Bible sometimes, is to be understood figuratively. And sometimes it's not. You'll read passages in the prophets that Jerusalem will see atrocities like had never been before and like will never been after. Talking about Babylonian captivity. And yet the trials and tribulations and the atrocities of 70 AD were multiple times worse than what happened to the people in 605 BC. You figurize a passage of Scripture when the Scripture tells you, or when the context tells you to figurize. And if it doesn't have any indication of figurization, then you accept it and you go on. In Genesis chapter 6, there was a flood in Noah's world. Every indication means the whole world. You've no reason to figurize it. In John chapter 5, verses 28 and 29, Jesus will say, Marvel not at this saying, the time will come when all are in the tombs will come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. Talking about the final coming of Christ. No reason to figurize that. In Ezekiel chapter 37, around verse 12, God speaks to Ezekiel and talks about a resurrection of the people of Israel, talking about coming out of Babylonian captivity. Figurization. There's a day of the Lord in Nahum, speaking of the destruction of Nineveh. Paul in 1 Thessalonians 5 will speak of a day of the Lord. Therefore, Paul is talking about the destruction of Nineveh, right? Wrong. Now, he wrote that Thessalonian letter early. I don't think he wrote it that early. Sometimes a similar phrase will mean something entirely different. The principle is the same, judgment. But it's not always the same judgment. In Isaiah 13, he talks about destruction of Babylon. Described in such a sense that the world is being destroyed. But the world is not being destroyed. Babylon is just figurative language showing that Babylon is judged and will never rise again. So we have these things all through the Bible. In Revelation chapter 17, we see the word Babylon. We know from the context he's talking about Rome. In 1 Peter, Peter speaks about Babylon. No reason to figurize it, although some do. But there's every reason in Peter to say Babylon is Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar rules his kingdom. How's it described? As the whole world. You notice he says the birds of the air are under his rule. Ask an eagle who your king is. Figurative language describing what is going on in the world of Babylon. So when you see passages like this, and there's a lot more, understand, sometimes this is language given to you and me expressing the circumstances or figurizing what's really being said. We'll see judgment pronounced upon kingdoms, nations, described as the destruction of the world. But it's not really the destruction of the world. It's just showing that they are being destructive. Now, if the language of judgment is described in destruction of a world, what would be the language of blessings? A new heaven and a new earth. Now, this may help you in some of these passages. So, we have Babylon as the head of gold. The second kingdom is the Medo-Persian kingdom. And then the third kingdom. And then the fourth kingdom. And this is where we'll start dragging our feet. The number of things to notice about the fourth kingdom. Verses 40 through 45. Let's read that. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdue all things, and as iron that crushes all these things, shall it break in pieces and crush. And whereas you saw the feet and toes, first mention of toes, part of the potter's clay and part of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as you saw the iron mixed with clay. And as the toes of the feet were part iron and part clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas you saw the iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron does not mingle with clay. And in those days, and in the days of those kings, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, nor shall the sovereignty thereof be left to another people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that break in pieces the iron and the brass and the clay and the silver and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain and the interpretation thereof sure. Now, notice what it says. It says the fourth kingdom. It doesn't say the fifth kingdom, not the sixth kingdom, or any other kingdom. It says the fourth kingdom. It is strong with as iron, and notice the pronoun it. Not them, not they, but it. It is a divided kingdom, not kingdoms. It, singular, is a divided kingdom. It is partly strong and is partly broken. The reason why, verse 43, it mingles with other people. And this is a good example of Rome. Rome, for all of its power, was actually a poor country, poor city. And the further she spread out, the greater her costs were. As she spread out, she made covenants with other people. She colonized. She set up client kings. She set up certain cities. What was that that Paul said in Acts 22 when he was talking to the Roman? He had bought, the Roman had bought his citizenship, thank you. But Paul says, I am a citizen born. Tarsus was one of those cities set up by Rome. We don't have time. Okay, let's do this. Let's quit here. I want you to think about the fourth kingdom till we get back next Sunday. I want you to bring the study guide back with you, because the ones I got remaining are going to cost you $4 a piece. Now, read what you can on it, and then we'll come back and discuss it, and then we'll get into the four different views of this fourth kingdom. I appreciate your attention. God bless you.